This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Gibbon. There will be no Summer Olympics this July. The IOC announced Tuesday that due to the coronavirus pandemic, the Tokyo Games will be postponed to 2021. Athletes and fans are disappointed, of course, but this move will also have tremendous consequences for the economies of Tokyo and Japan. And that's why I'm joined by Alistair Gale, the Wall Street Journal's Japan editor in Tokyo. Alistair, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me, Karen.
So I actually want to start back in 2013. There were three finalists bidding to host the 2020 Summer Games: Istanbul, Madrid, and Tokyo. Why was Tokyo bidding for the Games, and why ultimately do you think the IOC went with the city?
It was pitched really as a chance for the country to recover from the disaster that we had here in 2011 when there was a massive earthquake and a tsunami which killed about 20,000 people. They wanted to show, you know, give people something to look forward to. And also, you know, Japan had the Olympics in 1964 and it has a lot of facilities already. So it showed that it was able to be a good host. It had a compelling story to tell. And I think that's really, you know, one of the major reasons why it was successful.
So that was 2013. So what's happened in the years since to get ready for the Games, and how much money has been spent?
You know, it's been remarkably smooth. You know, often with Olympic buildups, you get stories of chaos and corruption, of facilities that are not going to be ready on time. But that really hasn't happened here in Japan. You know, it's been quite a smooth process. There are several new stadia and arenas that have been built, but all of that's gone very smoothly. I mean, the budget has grown from the original plan of around $7 billion to at least double that and perhaps more. So, you know, it's been costly, but it generally has had strong public support here. People are really looking forward to it.
It really says something about the Olympic process that only a budget of double is totally normal. So what has it been like to watch as Tokyo continued to prepare for these games, even while this pandemic spread across the globe? I have to imagine it was somewhat surreal.
Surreal is the right word. You know, we even had the Olympic flame arrived here last week. And I think there's a, you know, there's a widespread relief here that, you know, this thing is not now hanging over the country when the coronavirus situation here is actually getting worse. But there is a cost to keep things on hold for a year. And that amounts to a fair chunk of money, which, you know, is obviously not in the original budget and someone's going to have to pay for.
And then there's also a cost for hotels and restaurants and other businesses that have been getting ready for this influx of visitors. What will this delay mean for them?
Right. You know, they are the ones, I think, that are really going to be, you know, most hurt by this. And, you know, economic times are actually tough here in Japan, even without the coronavirus. You know, the economy is sort of close to a recession. So it's come at the worst possible time, really. I mean, I think it's also important to say that the coronavirus is the big thing here in terms of what's hurting the economy and what's hurting these businesses. You know, the uncertainty is whether it will be okay next year.
If these games do keep getting postponed, who's on the hook for the cost of that? I mean, does the IOC kick in at all?
Right. Well, that needs to be figured out from now on. There was a meeting with the organizing committee here in Tokyo, and at the start of the meeting, the CEO on the committee said, first thing we need to do is figure out exactly when the Olympics are going to be. Second thing we need to do is find out whether all the venues are going to be available for that new date. And then the third thing is, you know, figure out who's going to pay for all of this. Given the state of the economy here, you know, the central government and the Tokyo government are not going to be wanting to have to pay a whole lot more. They're trying to sort of keep the economy afloat and, you know, deal with the virus.
Perhaps it's silly to look for a silver lining in all of this, but aside from the obvious and huge potential public health benefits that come from postponing, are there any ways in which the Tokyo Games will actually be better because they were delayed for a year?
Well, I think if we have come through the global health crisis of the coronavirus, you know, the Olympics can be somewhat of a sort of celebration of humanity overcoming the virus. I mean, that's what the Prime Minister has said he wants this Olympics to be remembered for. So, best case scenario, that's what will happen.
That's Wall Street Journal Japan editor Alistair Gale in Tokyo. We'll have a link to some of the Wall Street Journal's recent coverage on the Olympic postponement at onlyagame.org. Thanks, Alistair.
Thank you.
Kevin Tyson is a former minor league baseball player, and he says he didn't know much about hockey. But while researching a book about the 1917 Stanley Cup Finals, Kevin came across another story about the 1919 Championship Series.
It was just a weird anomaly. It was kind of a cute little side story.
In recent weeks, Kevin has found himself thinking back on that story again and again.
All of a sudden, it's relevant. Like, as the coronavirus started to spread, I definitely was looking at it thinking this is eerily similar.
All right, so let's start at the beginning of the story that you researched. And I suppose in many ways, it begins towards the end of World War I with what was called the Spanish flu. Mm-hmm. So tell me about that pandemic. When did it start? How was it spread?
So it starts in the spring of 1918. So it starts a little bit earlier than the end of the war. But the biggest explosion certainly is in the fall of 1918, and I think that's when it's most lethal, right? And so you have all the soldiers returning home from all over the world, and they all return home to huge parades and public gatherings, and, you know, a lot of these guys are infected with, you know, the Spanish flu, which is the H1N1, right? So it's the swine flu that we had 10 years ago. Then there was no herd immunity to it. There was no vaccine to it. There was nothing, and it spread rapidly.
And by October of 1918, Seattle had pretty much shut everything down, right?
Correct. Yeah, that's correct. Schools had shut down, bars and restaurants had shut down, public gatherings had shut down.
That sounds really familiar.
Absolutely.
But in January of 1919, those restrictions were lifted. Bars and restaurants were back open, schools were back in session, and the Seattle Metropolitans were back on the ice. So tell me about the Seattle Mets.
So there's two leagues back then. It's similar to the American League and the National League in baseball, right? So you have the NHL at that point is the East Coast League, and the Pacific Coast Hockey Association is the West Coast League. The Metropolitans and the Vancouver Millionaires are, you know, widely regarded as the two best teams out west. And I think the Metropolitans were probably the better of the two teams.
That season, that hockey season started, and it seems like it was a rather short season because
Correct.
2 months later in March, the Stanley Cup Finals were set, and it was going to be the Seattle Mets and the Montreal Canadiens. And it was a 5-day train ride between those two cities. So all 5 games were to be held in Seattle.
Seattle Daily Times, March 17th, 1919. A mad scramble for World Series of Hockey tickets. That's what's going on now at the arena. At 8:30 this morning, fans were lined up for blocks in the pouring rain, waiting for the seat sale to commence. And the office didn't open until 9.
Seattle fans were pretty excited, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the arena in Seattle held 2,500 people, and they were packing it with 3,500 for these games. You know, there's standing room only. There's, you know, kids up on the roof looking through skylights and looking in the transoms over the doors. And yeah, it was a really exciting time. And really, you had this populace that needed something to celebrate, right? The war had been devastating, and this virus had been devastating, and it was finally something everyone could rally around and celebrate.
In describing the two teams, the Seattle Daily Times noted that the Canadians had the weight advantage over the Mets, but they also pointed out that Bad Joe Hall, at just 165 pounds, was still a factor to be reckoned with at all points in the game. So who was Bad Joe Hall?
Yeah, so Joe Hall's sort of the first enforcer in hockey. The thing that's interesting, he's a really skilled guy, he's a defenseman, but he's one of those first sort of nasty players that'll take your head off if you're not looking. And he was widely respected. You know, he was the guy that he's friends with all of them. You know, I think on the ice, everybody hated him and hated playing against him. And off the ice, they all loved him.
So game one, the locals had the advantage, to say the least.
Seattle Post-Intelligencer, Thursday, March 29th, 1919. Skating rings around the flying Frenchmen, Eastern champions, the Seattle Metropolitans, put the skids under the Montreal squad in the first game of the World's Hockey Title Series. The final score was 7-0, with the Seattle men on the long end of the count.
What happened in that game?
Yeah, so again, like I said, it's sort of the American League and the National League, and so there's slightly different rules. So the West Coast League has 7 on the ice. They have a position called the Rover. The East Coast League has 6. There's forward passing in the West. There's not in the East. So games 1, 3, and 5 are played by West Coast rules, and 2 and 4 are played by East Coast rules. And West Coast rules favor athleticism and speed, and it's more of a flow game. And, you know, the East Coast game is, you know, more individualistic.
So the two teams split those first 3 games kind of according to whose rules were in use.
Exactly.
Game 4 is where things start to get really interesting. So describe game 4 for me.
The game goes into 2 overtimes and players start collapsing on the ice at the end. You know, they get a standing ovation from the crowd, but they come in and decide they can't keep playing, and they declare it a tie. And at that time, they think that it's just exhaustion. And it's interesting. The game is widely, you know, considered the greatest game ever played, at least of that era.
They may be playing hockey championships for the next 1,000 years, but they'll never stage a greater struggle than that which held 4,000 spectators spellbound last night.
As entertaining as it was, it really messed up the schedule of the Stanley Cup Finals, right?
Absolutely. So the presidents of both leagues, Frank Calder and Frank Patrick, decide that they are going to replay by Eastern rules, and that from now on, they'll play until there's a winner. And so game 5 is played with Eastern rules. The Metropolitans go up 3 goals. You know, if all the fans in the arena think that the game's over. And again, exhaustion starts to kick in and guys start to collapse on the ice again. And this game, again, goes into overtime and the Canadians win. You know, and I don't think the Metropolitans are that stressed about it. I think they know that game 6 is going to be played by Western rules. And, you know, they wake up the next morning and life's completely changed for them.
So each team has now won 2 games. That game 4 tie has forced a deciding game 6. And it's pretty clear at this point that the players are under tremendous strain. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer printed a list of the injuries. And, well, the injuries, a lot of them are hockey injuries.
Seattle, Rowe, wrenched ankle. Foyston, torn tendon. Ricky, cut on leg.
But there are a number of players who are listed as having a fever or a high fever, and that sounds remarkably like not exhaustion, but the Spanish flu. Did the newspapers pick up on that, that these are not hockey injuries?
I mean, maybe they did, and maybe they're trying to avoid striking up fear again. But, you know, from everything that I've seen, nobody picked up on it until the day after Game 5's played.
Influenza has, within the past 48 hours, laid out 5 of the Canadiens.
2 Metropolitans, both head coaches, they all wake up with, you know, scary fevers, like 103, 104 degree temps. And at that point, the Canadiens don't have enough players to put a team on the ice, and they offer to forfeit the series. Pete Muldoon, the head coach for the Metropolitans, won't accept winning, you know, not on the ice. And so he declines the forfeit. As that's all happening, the health department swoops in and cancels the series. They talked about moving it to Vancouver a little bit, and then they talked about moving it to Montreal. They talked about waiting a few weeks. They ultimately just decided that the series goes down as a tie.
Okay, so 4 days after the game was called off, Joe Hall died. Mm-hmm. What was the reaction to that news?
It was, you know, horrible, right? It's a guy that was friends with all the players. You know, he's 37 years old. He has 3 young kids. He lived in Vancouver, British Columbia. So, you know, he was in some ways a local. Both teams went up for the funeral, and very, very, very sad time.
And while the others recovered, they didn't all come out of this unscathed, right?
Yeah, so George Kennedy, the owner of the Canadiens, he recovers from the short-term effects of this flu, but, you know, he has, you know, pretty severe health complications for the last 2 years of his life, and he passes away. And Pete Muldoon, who, you know, is the Metropolitans head coach, right? And this is a guy that was a professional boxer. He was an ice dancer, really, really super healthy guy. And he ends up having a heart attack 10 years later and dying at the age of 41. And again, 2 small kids. And there was a lot of thought then that he never fully recovered from the Spanish flu, that it potentially had weakened his heart. I read a stat that Spanish flu pandemic cut the life expectancy in America by 12 years.
Wow. So the 1919 Stanley Cup Final remains the only time a U.S. major professional sports championship ended with co-champions. You've gotten to spend, as I understand it, a little bit of time with the Stanley Cup itself. How is that year inscribed on the cup?
Yeah, it says 1919 Montreal Canadiens, Seattle Metropolitans, series not completed. When I first started researching the book, I wasn't sure, you know, if people cared about hockey, and I wasn't sure if the Stanley Cup was, you know, even a thing that was famous back then, and it certainly was. It was very, very important to the players, to the media, to the fans. You know, they were all very passionate about it. The city really wanted to win, the players really wanted to win, and they just ultimately couldn't make it happen.
What lessons do you take from this story?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the biggest things is just as you see the media reports and as this thing unfolds, I think one of the biggest points of fear is, you know, that we're in uncharted waters, right? Nobody's seen this before, and it certainly has never happened in our lifetime, but it has happened. You know, there are a lot of lessons that, you know, our government and the health department and our sports leagues, you know, can draw from that experience. And like the league came back, right? All the sports came back. The 1920 season starts, you know, just a little bit late. You know, it wasn't like it was this lingering hangover that took years and years and years for society and our economy and all those things to bounce back. You know, it happened rapidly. So for me, I draw a lot of, you know, hope from that and parallels from that, that, you know, we will get through this and things will bounce back, you know, quickly, and our economy will be humming again, our restaurants will be full, and, you know, our arenas will be packed.
So when you hear people complaining that all of their favorite sporting events have been taken away, what do you want to say to them?
I mean... This is sort of a bad answer, right? I mean, I was a professional baseball player and a college baseball coach, and like, it's tragic. I feel horrible for, you know, the college seniors and high school seniors that have lost, you know, something special, something that can never be given back to them. But also look at it like this, right? So, you know, let's hope that this thing doesn't get anywhere near what the Spanish flu pandemic did, right? And I don't think it will, but it was like 500 million that were infected and, you know, roughly 50 million died. And if you apply that to today's population, right, that's 2.6 billion that are infected and, you know, roughly 230 million that die. And it's horrible, right? I'm completely willing to give up my sports so that 230 million people don't have to die. I think that we can all come together as a community and hopefully continue to support our franchises and our businesses and all those things and get through this and have a great summer and watching sports, hopefully.
You said that was going to be a bad answer, but I don't think it was a bad answer at all.
I mean, I struggle when people are complaining about it.
Thanks so much for this. This has been really great.
Yeah, thank you for doing it. I think it's just like, it's a message that needs to get out there.
Kevin Tyson's book is When It Mattered Most, The Forgotten Story of America's First Stanley Cup and the War to End All Wars. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. When David Meller was 18 years old, he was hit by a car twice. His dreams of playing Major League Baseball were over, but his struggle was just beginning.
I had 1 to 5 vivid, lifelike nightmares every night for 29 years.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Want to add more positivity to your podcast feed? Check out Kind World, stories of extraordinary kindness and compassion.
That's Kind World. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given. This was supposed to be baseball's opening week. My husband and I were supposed to be going to Fenway Park, next Thursday actually, because the home opener is always a little later in Boston. And we were supposed to eat peanuts and sit in uncomfortably small seats, enjoying the fresh, chilly air. Instead, I'm recording this program in my closet again. But you know, sometimes life throws you curveballs. Sometimes it's downright cruel. And that's what this next story is about. Here's Vic Vella from the podcast Back from Broken.
David Meller was a standout pitcher in high school. He was even weighing scholarship offers from college teams. But one summer evening in 1981, everything changed. David and a friend were on their way home from the movies, and they decided to grab a bite at McDonald's.
I forgot my wallet, and I went back to the car and picked up my wallet, shut the door, and took a few steps to head back toward the restaurant. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw a car come off the street, and they stopped, and then they motioned for me to go ahead and walk. So I started walking, and I heard them rev their engine and squeal their tires. And I saw the car speeding toward me, so I raised both my hands and my left leg, and the car hit me.
Wow.
And threw me 20 feet in the air.
David says the pain was really intense, and the scene was chaotic. But the hell he was going through wasn't over yet. The driver, who was just learning how to drive, panicked and stepped on the gas pedal again. And so the car hit David a second time.
Metal bumper hit the metal handrail and sparks flew. And the car's engine was revving and the car was pinning the bumper against my knee. And I was screaming at the lady to stop, stop. And
oh my God.
Trying to push the car off of me. And I can see the lady just staring at me in a panic. Chills are running through me. The pain is intense, but I just can't get the car to stop.
An investigation showed it was a freak accident. The woman behind the wheel had simply stepped on the gas instead of the brake.
It hurt the first time when the car hit me. The second time it hit me was even more intense. And, you know, I thought, what am I going to do? I was worried if my leg was crushed, what was I going to do with my life if I couldn't play baseball?
David Meller could see his destiny mapped out in front of him at a very young age. He was a gifted athlete with a powerful arm, and he loved baseball. In fact, professional baseball was in his blood. His grandfather played in the majors in 1902, and even though he grew up in Ohio, David Meller was a diehard Boston Red Sox fan. He even nicknamed his backyard fence the Green Monster after the Red Sox famous outfield wall at Fenway Park.
I just lived and breathed baseball constantly. I would call into our local small radio station at night to get a Red Sox score before I went to sleep and played wiffle ball, imitating all the Red Sox players in my backyard.
David was on his way to follow in his grandfather's footsteps until that summer evening when David was in high school and he and a friend decided to go to McDonald's. He remembers the intense pain as he headed to the hospital. And in the hours after the accident, he faced more than just physical pain.
I remember waking up screaming from the first nightmare that first night. And it was just, the nightmare was just so vivid and lifelike, like I had just relived the whole accident again.
Did you have one the next night?
I did. In fact, I had 1 to 5 vivid, lifelike nightmares every night for 29 years.
David, 29 years.
Yes, sir. The nightmares were so intense that I was scared to go to sleep.
David had 3 different surgeries.
When I came out of the surgery, I said, Doc, you know, how soon can I play ball? And he said, you won't play baseball again. He says, you'll be lucky to walk normal again. And he put quotation fingers, normal, and I mean, tears just started pouring down my face. And, I was bound and determined to prove him wrong. Maybe I wouldn't be able to pitch again, but I was going to walk normal. And I was an 18-year-old kid, you know, kind of mad at the world. And there were a lot of tough days.
But one good thing did happen while David was in physical therapy. He met someone who changed his life. It started when his buddy took him out on a blind date with a woman named Denise.
I was walking with a cane, and she liked me for who I was. She didn't judge me for my limp. She didn't judge me for how I got around. In fact, she got me out to dance at a place we went after dinner, and she just accepted me for who I was.
Would you have met her had you not been involved in the accident?
No, sir. I would have been away at college playing baseball. I literally fell in love with her that night.
Around this time, David thought hard about what he'd do now that playing baseball wasn't an option. He liked mowing lawns in the neighborhood growing up. He liked being outside. So he got the idea to be a groundskeeper for Major League Baseball. He took some college courses in how to care for turf grass.
And my brother lived in Milwaukee at the time. And so I reached out to the Brewers and sent them many, many, many letters and many, many phone calls and kind of became that squeaky wheel. And the Brewers finally said, we'll give you an opportunity to work for the games only. You know, I was in the majors and I was so excited to be there. My job's the next best thing to playing.
David worked his way up from the game day crew and became a major league groundskeeper in 1984. And his personal life was great. He married Denise and they had two daughters. But David was haunted by getting hit by that car twice in the McDonald's parking lot. He had quietly suffered through those intense nightmares since that first car accident. So he tried to cope by working all the time.
Because if I kept busy, the symptoms weren't as bad. And I remember when the girls were probably 5 and 3, when my wife was driving by the park and she overheard our oldest daughter tell our youngest daughter, hey, look, that's where Dad lives. And I thought that was the lesser of the two evils. I thought that was better on my family than me going home and having mood swings. When I had quiet time, I didn't want to go to sleep. It's just a matter of how soon the nightmares would start.
Wow, David, did you dread going to bed at night?
Yes, sir. I was scared to go to sleep. I would do everything I could to watch TV to not fall asleep. I mean, I was scared. I was embarrassed. I didn't think there was anybody that could relate to what I was going through.
And then the guy who'd been hit by a car twice in 1981 got hit again.
I was raking out in left field near an irrigation head. And I heard a car, and I thought, that's odd that there would be a car noise inside the park.
He was at Milwaukee County Stadium, standing on the field not long after the team wrapped up its 1995 season.
I turned, and there was a car coming from behind the bleachers toward the open field gate.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I put both my arms up and yelled to the car to stop. And the lady smiled as big as she could and stepped on the gas and came right at me. She hit me. I hit the windshield and landed in a pile at the base of the outfield wall pads.
The woman in the car kept going, driving along the warning track at the edge of the ball field. But then
she veered the car and turned, aiming right at me. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is it. She's literally gonna just run me right over. And at the last moment, she veered to the left to miss me and slammed on the brakes and stopped right beside me.
David, I have so many questions. First of all, you must have been thinking, why me?
Yeah, it just, you know, it kind of happened so fast. It was a lot to process. Yes, sir.
Did you think you were going to die?
When I was laying there on the ground and she was aiming right at me again, you know, I did. I thought I was going to die.
The attack was random. The driver had a history of mental illness. She'd previously threatened the Queen of England and tried to assault Oprah Winfrey. David went to court during her trial, and he says that was also a traumatic experience.
And it just really intensified my nightmares, and it made me look over my shoulder and feared for my family.
But David just kept doing his job, and he did it so well, another team became interested in hiring him.
Mr. Joe Mooney, who was the groundskeeper for the Red Sox for 30 years, called out of the blue. He called and said, David, I'm thinking about retiring, but I'll only retire if you replace me.
So David became the head groundskeeper of Fenway Park, home of his favorite team and the real Green Monster. So you started your job the next year, which was 2001, and any baseball fan knows that that was just before the Red Sox started shaking off that curse and finally won a World Series a couple years later.
The Boston Red Sox are world champions.
David, I can't imagine the thrill of that. Being a lifelong Sox fan and then being part of the first World Series victory in almost a century. And yet, you were dealing with decades of PTSD. When did you finally decide to get some help?
You know, I think there's a lot of different aha moments in our lives. I'd get acupuncture for pain management. And before treatment, there was a large table there with probably 50 magazines on it. And I just happened to pick up a Smithsonian magazine. And the first page I opened was an article about a new treatment facility for veterans dealing with post-traumatic stress.
And everything just clicked in that moment. The symptoms that plagued the veterans in that article had also been following David around for almost three decades.
Involuntary trembling.
Irritability.
Restlessness.
Depression.
Nightmares.
Flashbacks.
Insomnia.
Emotional numbness.
Sensitivity to noise.
And tendency to seek solace in alcohol.
And as I read that, chills just ran through me. And tears started pouring down my face.
Wow.
As I realized I either actively had or had dealt with 10 of those 12 symptoms. And while it scared the heck out of me, it gave me hope. I thought you had to be in the military to get PTSD. I had no idea you could get it any other way. And I went home right away and I said, honey, we've got to talk. And I opened up my soul. And all those things I had feared she might say, she didn't say. I mean, I should have given her credit all those years before. And I went to Mass General the next day to start counseling. And I walked in with my hat pulled down, hoping no one would recognize me and say, why are you here? Now, I'm proud to be a PTSD survivor. I'm proud to say I went through counseling, and I'm proud to say I go to counseling. And a therapist has changed my world for the better, and more importantly, changed my family's life for the better. You know, we had to work through to desensitize all these raw, buried emotions one by one. And each one was a kraken, like a sea monster with tentacles. And February 25th, 2011, I slept for the first night in 29 years. I slept 7 hours straight and did not have a nightmare.
Good for you.
I felt like jumping up and down on the bed like Tom Cruise did on Oprah's sofa. I was so excited.
Getting therapy, learning how to deal with PTSD, all of that gave David a new perspective.
You know, I've been hit by a car three times and I figure that's better than four. And I've had 45 surgeries, and I figure that's better than 46. I really feel blessed.
That story came from Vic Vella. He's the host of a brand new podcast from Colorado Public Media called Back from Broken. You should definitely check it out. David Meller's book is One Base at a Time. We'll have links at onlyagame.org.
Days after September 11th, 2001, while flights were still grounded, a state senator drove from Omaha to Chicago with Mr. Cub, Ernie Banks. And during that very long car ride, the state senator learned things about the Hall of Famer most people never knew. That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Need to escape the news for a moment?
Check out Endless Thread, a podcast from WBUR and Reddit.
From mysteries to histories to stories that will remind you of our shared humanity.
Subscribe to Endless Thread on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, comedian Gary Goldman returns to the show with advice on how sports fans can stay healthy in a world without our usual sports. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me virtually with the week's sports news. Hi, Charlie. How are you holding up?
Hi, Karen. I'm distancing socially very enthusiastically.
So Thursday should have been opening day. Opening day it was not. But on Thursday, MLB and the Players Union agreed to a deal that will distribute $170 million to players over the next 2 months, with most of that going to those with guaranteed major league contracts. Is it just me, or are those the guys who could probably pay their mortgages even if they missed a couple of paychecks?
Yeah, I think this was pretty much a deal to keep both sides out of court for the next 50 years. Because if there had been some sort of reneging on guaranteed contracts or something, there would have been all kinds of lawyers, you know, chiming in from their home offices.
The league hopes to start games as early as June, potentially without fans in attendance. That would extend the regular season into October, with playoff games at neutral sites in November. Are you ready for the boys of November?
There's also Scott Boras's proposal, which would have them playing a World Series game on Christmas. which is, you know, the NBA is going to have a cow if that happens, because Christmas is owned by the NBA. I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, we're going to have to accept the year 2020 as being sui generis in so many ways, and this may be one of them.
Charlie, did you tune into Steph Curry's Instagram Live interview with Dr. Anthony Fauci? Because 50,000 people did, including former President Barack Obama.
Yeah, well, you know, Barack's a very big Steph fan and a very big Anthony Fauci fan, so of course he would. This is something that, you know, Steph Curry found that he could do besides just, you know, writing checks, so he could actually, you know, get some information out there. And I'm sure Fauci was glad to be, you know, sharing a podium with anybody except the president. So it was a win-win.
Well, I want to play just a little clip.
When it comes to dealing with each individual case, like how are we addressing the testing issue?
Okay, great question. That's been a real issue early on.
Steph isn't a bad interviewer, but beyond that, I'm fascinated by the fact that this interview is likely to reach an entirely different demographic than, say, a White House briefing.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're gonna get a lot of young people, which is important because there has been a problem of young people believing they have some sort of natural immunity to this thing. And Steph will reach those people. And I think that's all for the good.
The NFL draft will start on April 23rd as scheduled. And teams worried that they won't have enough time to vet potential draftees are being told not to complain about it. Commissioner Roger Goodell's memo obtained by ESPN's Adam Schefter reads, quote, "Public discussion of issues related to the draft serves no useful purpose and is grounds for disciplinary action." That's a tad draconian, don't you think?
Well, you got to understand that Roger Goodell, with any disciplinary power whatsoever, is like handing a toddler a flamethrower. Something's going to burn down that you don't want to burn down. You know, I don't have a lot of sympathy for teams either. I mean, they ought to know by now, you know, who they're going to draft and why. If they don't, the ownership, the management of the team should quit and let the janitorial staff take its place.
Well, the worry here is that teams in hard-hit areas like California and New Jersey will be at a competitive disadvantage because they're on work-from-home orders, while teams in other areas are still free to go to work. But you know what could solve that? The NFL could just say, for the good of the public health, everybody should work from home. Crazy idea.
Or they could postpone the draft,
right,
which is also a possibility. I mean, you can watch film at home. I'm sure Bill Belichick does.
You can record a radio show from
home. Bill Belichick probably has something that looks like the Situation Room at home.
I'm sure he does. I'd like to offer a shout out to Elisha Nachimovich, a 32-year-old restaurant worker living in France, who ran an entire marathon back and forth on his 23-foot-long balcony. The feat took 6 hours and 48 minutes, and he did it to show people that even though they're stuck at home, they can still get some exercise. What exercise have you gotten today, Charlie?
I've managed to get from my working chair to the telephone, and I can do it repeatedly. This was a 7-meter balcony, by the way, but good for Alicia for showing us indomitability in the face of incredible boredom.
And finally, Charlie, the English Football Association has been forced to issue a statement saying that they are not, I repeat, they are not planning to use Wembley Stadium to bake the world's largest lasagna with slices to be delivered by flying drones to those affected by the coronavirus outbreak. Wait, what?
Dudes, if I may say this to our brethren and sistren in the UK, don't believe everything you see on the internet, okay? This was some guy's joke. However, drone-delivered lasagna does sound like an appealing prospect.
Sign me up. I mean, yeah.
I mean, yum, right?
Right. Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie, and stay safe.
Thank you, Karen. You too.
sometimes, when the world is topsy-turvy and nothing feels familiar, people let their guards down. We're given opportunities to learn things about ourselves and our friends that we might not have known. Ron Rappaport wrote about one such story in Let's Play 2, his 2019 biography of Baseball Hall of Famer Ernie Banks. And we like that story so much, we decided to give it a double play. That's what we call our occasional series, where we turn a newspaper column or a book chapter into a radio drama.
On the morning of September 11th, 2001, former Illinois State Senator William Maravitz was awakened in a hotel room in Omaha, Nebraska, by the sound of a ringing telephone.
"Turn on the TV,"
the voice in his ear said.
"It's early,"
Maravitz said.
"Turn it on."
"All running away very, very quickly."
Together, they watched smoke billowing from the North Tower of the World Trade Center in New York and the chaos in the streets below.
"Oh, my God."
Then they gasped in unison as a second plane struck the South Tower.
"So this looks like it is some sort of a concerted effort to attack the World Trade Center that is..."
Maravitz hurriedly dressed and took a cab to the golf course not far away. There he joined more than 100 others who had been invited to attend an outing arranged by Warren Buffett, the businessman, investor, and philanthropist, and one of the world's richest men.
"For the first time in my life, I'm speechless."
But those who had flown to Omaha should entertain no thoughts of returning home anytime soon, Buffett warned.
"I know many of you have your own planes, but it doesn't matter. The sky is closed."
Maravitz looked around for the two men he had previously arranged to play with. Stedman Graham, a Chicago businessman who is best known as the fiancé of Oprah Winfrey, and Ernie Banks, the Hall of Fame baseball player who had spent his entire career with the Chicago Cubs. As they made their way around the golf course, they could see Buffett visiting with each group of golfers and giving them updates on the attacks. As he approached them, Buffett's walkie-talkie crackled.
"Mr. Buffett, Air Force One has just landed in Omaha."
The plane carrying President George W. Bush had arrived at nearby Offutt Air Force Base, the headquarters of the United States Strategic Command, which contained an underground bunker built to withstand a nuclear blast.
"At that point, we don't know if we're in the safest place in the world or the most dangerous."
At breakfast the next morning, Graham told Maravitz and Banks that Winfrey would be sending a plane. But as the day wore on, it became clear that not even Oprah Winfrey would be able to breach the closure of the nation's air traffic. And for two more days, Buffett's out-of-town visitors remained stranded. On the third day, Maravitz began making calls and found a rental agency that had a car available. He invited his golfing companions to join him, but Graham held firm. He would wait for Winfrey's plane, he said. But Banks said,
"I'm coming with you."
And after getting directions from the hotel, the two men set off on a trip to Chicago they were told would take about 7 hours. Despite Banks's constant public display of good cheer, Maravitz and others who knew him well were aware of another, more complicated side of his personality. Upon meeting people, Banks would always ask a question and then follow up with more. Only later would those talking to him realize that he had not said a single word about himself.
He'd ask me,
"How's that new restaurant doing? Are you going to run for office? Have you seen the mayor lately?"
Over the years, the people closest to Banks had learned that these questions, and especially his two best-known greetings,
"Are you married?"
and
"How's your wife?"
were a defense mechanism. As long as he was asking questions, he didn't have to answer them. He was widely hailed as baseball's greatest ambassador. He exuded happiness and insisted there was nothing he would rather do than play baseball. He never refused to give an interview or sign an autograph. And his signature line,
"It's a beautiful day for a ball game. Let's play two,"
became a much quoted and much parodied part of the American vocabulary. But he would not talk about himself. But as the two men rode through the flat Midwestern landscape, Banks began to talk. And for the first time since Maravitz had known him, and the last, he talked about himself. He talked about growing up as the oldest boy in a family of 12 in Dallas and the responsibilities that entailed. Once, he had missed a year of school to help his father pick cotton. He talked about playing for the Kansas City Monarchs as the Negro Leagues were in their final years because the best young black players were following Jackie Robinson and the other pioneers into the major leagues. He talked about Buck O'Neill, Cool Papa Bell, and all the others who had missed their chance because they had been born too soon, and how they compensated by teaching those who came after everything they knew. He talked about the women in his life and the mistakes he had made with them, one after another. He talked about his distant relationship with his three children and how he wished he had been a better father. He talked about his teammates who had become as close as family during their playing days. He talked about Leo Durocher, who had humiliated and mocked him while Durocher was managing the Cubs, and how he had responded with silence and runs batted in. He talked about the piercing disappointment of the Cubs' fabled, faded season of 1969, when the city and its fans had been on fire until the all-too-bitter end. He talked about the pain of never having played in a World Series and the fear that he would be remembered more for that piece of bad luck than for the great player he had been. He talked about the pleasures and burdens of being the very symbol of his team, a one and only Mr. Cub.
Hey, hey, holy mackerel, no doubt about it, the Cubs are on their way. Hey, hey, hey! Let's do it again here. Get it up a little bit. Put it back.
The hours rolled by, and Maravitz, fascinated by Banks' stories about himself, fascinated that Banks was telling stories about himself, glanced up and saw a sign that said, Clare City.
This doesn't seem right,
he thought. He had been distracted by Banks' monologue, he realized, and not paying attention to where they were going. He had better stop and check the directions he'd been given back at the hotel.
Chicago?
The man at the gas station said and burst out laughing.
Ha! You came the wrong way, fella.
Maravitz had not driven east from Omaha toward Illinois, he was told, but north into South Dakota. He had driven through South Dakota, in fact, almost to the North Dakota border. The seven-hour trip he had planned would now take at least 14. Laughing at the absurdity of it all, he gave his passenger the bad news, turned the car around, and headed for home. Ernie Banks talking about himself all the while.
That was from the prologue of Ron Rappaport's 2019 biography, Let's Play 2, The Legend of Mr. Cub, The Life of Ernie Banks. We first aired that piece back in April of 2019 as part of an occasional series we call Double Play. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.